Unfortunately for historians like me, they went out of existence as of 1841. And then you have about 15-year period in New York with no black press, and then it comes back again in the later 1850s. So the information begins to become harder to come by in the mid-1840s and 1850s. So it's, you know, it's like a little detective story here. You've got to pick up pieces from all over the place. But, you know, the information is there if you look hard enough.
In the last seconds we have with you, yeah, the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War is coming up.
In April, right. And then the 150th anniversary begins of Reconstruction. And as you said, I wrote a very long book on Reconstruction, and I do believe we need to think again about Reconstruction, because the issues of Reconstruction, of citizenship, of voting rights, of terrorism like the Klan, are still facing our country today.
And that's where we're going to continue in part two of our conversation, and we'll post it online at democracynow.org. Eric Foner has been our guest, author of Gateway to Freedom, The Hidden History of the Underground Railroad. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, history professor, DeWitt Clinton professor at Columbia University. He won the Pulitzer for The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, and also wrote Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863-77. That does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aramate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, and Malcolm Honey Masuga, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guster, Amy Lufo. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for qualified candidates to fill two vacant board seats. The KBOO Board of Directors invites qualified KBOO members who are interested in becoming a board member to submit a candidate statement no longer than 500 words, which should include the applicant's experience, information about previous board or coalition experience, and why they want to serve on the KBOO Board of Directors. Please email your candidate statement to Timothy Welp at kboocommunity@gmail.com by March 13th, 2015. Candidates should also plan on being present at the March 23rd, 6 p.m. KBOO Board of Directors meeting to present a short statement about why they are interested in joining KBOO Board of Directors. Again, KBOO is looking for qualified candidates to serve on the Board of Directors. Application due March 13th and public presentations will be made March 23rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/boardvacancies2015.
It takes all of us to keep KBOO strong. KBOO is your radio station. Did you know that you can give gifts of stock to KBOO? We are able to quickly turn these donations into support for the important daily work of KBOO. How do you do this? Call 503-231-8032, extension 201, or email monica@kboo.org for information on how to make a stock gift. Thank you for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
This is Graham Nash.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM here in Portland. My name is Paul Rowland, and we started off with the wrong song. So we're just going to go straight to the program. Meant to play Don't Dig Here by David Crosby and Graham Nash, which relates to this topic we're going to talk about, because it was about not digging up uranium. I'm here with Mimi Gurman. Good morning.
Hey, Paul. How you doing?
I'm good. So, it's 4 years already.
I know, it's hard to believe, and yet we're going to be saying the same thing in 10 years and 20 years if we're still here to say that stuff, you know, because this isn't going away anytime soon.
And we're talking about, of course, the Fukushima Daiichi ongoing nuclear disaster and an event that you're organizing for this afternoon at noon at Pioneer Square.
Right, rain or shine, we're going to meet in Pioneer Square at noon, and we're calling the event a Requiem for the Ocean, and it's all about naming everything we can that lives in the Pacific and honoring it, and putting out as much energy as we can to all of our animals out there in the ocean who need our love right now because they're getting poisoned from Fukushima. There's a lot of other different kinds of toxins in the ocean as well, but today the focus is on radiation poisoning.
And so that's at noon at Pioneer Square in downtown Portland, if you happen to be in the area or want to make a special trip. So, yeah, we're going to be talking about all kinds of things related to Fukushima. It's something that we don't talk about here on KBOO all that much. You certainly don't hear much elsewhere in the media. It's a difficult subject. It's a difficult subject to think about. It was terrifying from the very beginning. And obviously, in the immediate aftermath, or the Pacific Northwest was dosed with a certain amount of airborne radiation, which your group, No Nukes Northwest, and your RADcast helped to document. And I don't know if we know any of the dimensions of any increased illnesses due to that in the Pacific Northwest. Any surmises about that? We can talk about that as well. But the number to call is 503-231-8187. We've got a whole hour, a little less than an hour at this point, to go into all this. If you yourself, you know, want to talk about your feelings about this, if you have any particular knowledge about this, any questions, Mimi has wide resources and connections in the field, and is one of the local people who can help us understand what is currently going on and what the dimensions of this ongoing crisis are. So yeah, let's just start by talking about that, because that's something you focused a lot of energy on, the airborne radiation. Can you, yeah, just talk about what the current state of your knowledge is about what is in the ground and water, and is there any radiation continuing to come over the ocean?
These are all really good questions. And what we know is right after 3/11 happened, Arne Gundersen, or somebody, came down to the Pacific Northwest and started to test air filters to find out what was here. Did we have particles in our air? We were pretty sure we did. And sure enough, we did. And those were found in Seattle and Portland, well, Oregon. And so we know that we were hit really hard. When you can find particles of, you know, plutonium and radiation and filters, it's not a good thing. And what that means is that people all across the Pacific Northwest were breathing in, or potentially breathing in, particles from Fukushima. And so starting from that point, we have data from that. So what a lot of people were doing at that point across the world were purchasing Geiger counters. And so we started to collect readings from different areas around the U.S. from people who started this right away. And we were very lucky that we had people doing this from the beginning. I came in a little bit late. I came in about a year later with No Nukes Northwest, and we purchased a Geiger counter. What we know now is that we have about a 40% increase in 35 to 40% increase in background radiation from where we began almost 3 years ago in testing all around Portland. And we know that because we have really good Geiger counters that tell us these things. And these Geiger counters, just to let you guys know, we talked about this a lot on KBOO. You can get them. One of the things I do is I help you decide what one to get. And I can only stress that you don't just go online and get anything because you're probably going to get a lemon. So I'm here for you to contact. In the meantime, back to the subject, we do have an increase in radiation, and it has sort of plateaued off, at least for the time being, and we watch on a daily basis, so we're waiting to see what's going to happen. What we do know as well is that there's constantly steam offs at Fukushima Daiichi. There's always steam happening there somewhere. And when that steam goes up into the air, it can come here and in our rain come back down and fall out. You know, it's here. We need to start to talk about this because I know that the Oregon Department of Health is not talking about it. And we're working on something right now showing that the Oregon Department of Health will not participate in the health of all of us here in Cascadia. So we need your help. We need your help to learn about this stuff and join in so that we have a more mass movement together to make some change happen and make our departments that are supposed to help take care of us take care of us.
So I mean, I don't know, I'm kind of asking you as if you know, you have knowledge about all these different areas, but do you know anything about, like, what sort of measures can be taken? I mean, let's just say, I mean, we'll get into, you know, the current state of the plants, the nuclear plants at Fukushima Daiichi in the program here, and, you know, possible continuing, ongoing releases, new potential developments that might happen there. But, you know, just say there is some new large release, or, you know, say something happens at Hanford, you know, who knows, that comes this way. Are there measures that can actually be taken to deal with the radiation? Or is it just like this fatalist, do we have just have to have a fatalistic, because that's kind of, I think that's kind of the one reason why people don't want to address it, because radiation just seems like this, just such a scary kind of invisible thing that what do you do about it?
Well, there's a, it's a deep question, and here are the answers. So we don't need a huge release from Fukushima. These low-level releases of radiation are enough to affect all of us and create cancers within us. Whether they're coming from Hanford, which they are as well, or the Columbia Generating Station, which is our very own Cascadia nuclear power plant online, near Hanford, or from Fukushima, we're getting low levels of radiation that are higher than background. We're not talking about just background. We're talking about ionizing radiation. And what we know scientifically and medically is that low levels of radiation does cause cancer. We can never say that low levels of radiation do not cause cancer. So we're getting hit with that now. So then to address the question of what can we do about it, well, the only thing that's left to do about it that's extremely positive is to take part in closing down every single nuclear power plant in the world. And we've got 99 left online in the United States. And I'm sure there's one, if people are listening to me in Iowa, you know, you can find one. Up at the lakes, you can find one. On the East Coast, you can find one. There's many. And we have to shut them all down before we continue this constant barrage of low-level radiation. And that's the best scenario. The worst scenario is that any one of these 99 that are left running melt down due to frozen pipes from this new, you know, the new thing that we're getting with climate change is nuclear plants are freezing. They weren't built to sustain these frigid temperatures in the Midwest. And we've already had shutdowns this year. We've had floods that have affected nuclear power plants in the Midwest last year and the year before. These are bad. These things cause meltdowns. So
it was in Nebraska, right?
I can't remember where. There's so many accidents every day, and our group and groups around the United States are always looking at, by the way, if you want to know what's going on any day in any nuclear power plant, you can go to the NRC website, and I think it's nrc.gov, and they have a page on their website. It's very easy to read, and it's called Events. And an event is not a party. An event is a problem at a nuclear power plant. They list events all the time. And that gives you a sense of how we're just minutes away from our own nuclear disaster here in the U.S. So that's the biggest go-to, that's the biggest get for us with wanting to survive, is shutting down nuclear power plants. But we can't do anything right now about that low-level radiation.
Like, you know, taking seaweed and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, if you're taking West Coast seaweed, if you're eating that, you're getting radiated, because our West Coast seaweed is radiated from the Pacific, and that's a fact. There is a guy in Maine. I like to put his information out because he's very cool. He's fourth generation from a family that collects seaweed and sells seaweed. And I think his website is theseaweedman.com. And he's out of Maine. He has all of his seaweed tested for radiation specifically. So you can get his seaweed. And yeah, there are books on nutrition and ways to help build up your immune system against these things. I will list them later today on Radcast. I have a place, I can't find it at the moment, there's so much on Radcast, for books. And I will post that today at some point. And I'll put those nutrition books in there. And these are just ways to boost your immune system, but you can't defeat radiation.
So, from that, let's get into the subject that is the subject of your event happening this afternoon in Portland, Requiem for the Ocean. The airborne is one thing, but the water that they used to, the only thing they could do, or you know, given the fact that they didn't have a coordinated international response, which many people called for, which, you know, who knows what sort of creative solutions, given, you know, massive technological and financial, you know, support for that, who knows what they could have come up with, probably way better than what they did. But what they did come up with was massive amounts of water flushing, keeping those plants cool. And so all that water just spills or overflows into the has been overflowing into the Pacific Ocean. So there's this huge plume, which has just as of as of January or late last year, they finally started seriously detecting it along the west coast of the United States. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. It's here.
And there's lots of different. You know, I've been trying to read up a little bit on it. You know, there's these acceptable levels, and so the articles I'm reading say that you know, it's 1,000 times below or something the acceptable levels. Currently, it's been diluted. I don't know how many millions of times by the time it gets here or whatever. You might have something to say about that, but let's just talk about it's, you know. He, of course, has been diluted by the time it gets here, but the closer it is to Japan, and just think of, you know, all the terrible price that the Japanese people have had to face in eating the food that's been radiated and probably continuing to eat all the seafood. So, yeah, talk about, you know, that plume. And, I mean, do we have any solid knowledge? I mean, is there any serious research being done about, you know, it's like at various depths, ocean depths, it's like, as I said, it gets diluted the further it gets. So like the difference between, you know, 5 miles from Japan, 100 miles, 200, I mean, these are, it's a huge ocean.
Yeah, one of the things, we know a lot, but we don't know nearly enough. And the reason for that is that our government isn't invested in finding these numbers out, or if they are, they're certainly not telling us about it, which is my guess. What we don't know won't hurt us kind of attitude, as we know from our government. But what we do know now, there's a new report that just came out recently, a couple weeks ago, about freshwater fish. We've already known as of maybe even two or 2.5 to 3 years ago that we had a lot of fish that was radiated in the ocean. We knew about the tuna. We knew about herring. We knew about a lot of things. We knew about the seaweed. But now they're finding, I want to read this, freshwater fish near off the coast of Japan is now incredibly radiated. This is freshwater fish. So
what do you mean off the coast of Japan?
This is near Japan. So right. this wasn't detected in fish by our coast. Okay, so we're back there with what is going on from the radiation. And again, if this is happening over there, whatever happens over there is eventually going to happen in other places, because it's all about bioaccumulation. These fish aren't going to stay right where they are. And they're not, you know, it's big fish, little fish.
So, by freshwater, are you talking about anadromous fish?
Yes.
Okay. Fish that go, that are born in freshwater and go to the ocean, then come back to freshwater. Okay.
So what they found is the bioaccumulation of radiation from bottom dwellers on up with have higher amounts of cesium than previously thought. This is what happens. Every few months or every year, we're going to get another report saying, well, we thought this, but it's really this. So this is the latest of what is. So higher amounts of cesium than previously thought. Strontium-90 contributed up to more than a half the dose rate contributed in 2013. So we are up by 50% from where we were a year ago or 2 years ago by this. It's really 1.5 years.
And where are these numbers coming from?
These numbers I have, I'll send you over the link for this. This came out in a science article, in a science journal. A more complete record is emerging of radionuclide measurements in fish tissue, sediment, and seawater samples near the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant and across the Pacific Ocean. The analysis is that all of the benchmark levels from 2012 to 2014 were incredibly higher now than we were just then. So all of these samples have in ovaries, in muscle, in bone, in organs, all of this has cesium and strontium in it. So again, when we think of bioaccumulation, the fish are not going to stay put where they are. And eventually these fish, you know, get sold to our market, which is a whole other story about bringing in the TPP and what the TPP is going to be able to do, and what we won't have anything to say about it at that point with Japanese imports coming in. We don't even have anything to say about it now. And we're importing Japanese fish, Japanese products, and these things are radiated, folks. I mean, maybe not every single thing, but what do you know? What do you know at your house that you're eating when you eat rice or anything from Japan? The chances are good, since the area around Fukushima was a huge rice harvesting area, that we're getting radiated fish, radiated rice and radiated fish.
And of course they don't, that's not labeled.
No, it's
on
not.
On packages, right. where it comes from.
Right. So I bring this up to show
even
you.
Even in like tea, like for example, I mean.
It is in tea.
Like. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to look. I mean, it just makes it really difficult to, you know, you know, to go about our daily lives in a normal way, I tell you. But so yeah, I look at tea, and try to see, you know, does it come from China? Does it come from Sri Lanka? Does it come from India? Does it come from Moa? And even there, it's, you know, obvious. You know, you try to. I try to avoid tea from Japan. You know.
We should all be avoiding all foods from Japan, anything. Even cars have been coming in with radiated parts. I mean, it's...
You get to this weird kind of, you know, like economic thing. So it's like, are we punishing, you know, the Japanese then?
We aren't punishing them at all. We have a free ride for them, in fact. There's zero punishment. It's not punishment. There's zero... what's the word? Lack of entry. We have an open gate for everything that they want to give us. And Hillary Clinton set that up right after Fukushima happened and said, we've got your back. And so there's no restrictions. There are zero restrictions on what's coming in. Nothing is tested. In fact, I spoke to Homeland Security down at the ports 3 years ago and said, what are you guys doing down at the boats that are coming in with this cargo? Are you testing it? And they said, yes. And I said, with what? And they said, well, we have, you know, we look for bombs. And that's what they said. And I said, are you testing for radiation? And they said, no.
And I guess, of course, the nature of the question, and this is a complex, you know, discussion, is, you know, okay, so this is a tremendously terrible, painful thing that happened to the island of Japan, the people of Japan, all the living beings in Japan, all the geophysical processes in Japan. And, you know, in order to deal with it, obviously, you know, in the economic setup we have now, you need money. So, I mean, you don't want to just like, okay, you know, we have to stop all economic activity with Japan and then their, you know, economy collapses. But that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is the fact that, I mean, Japan, they refused to have a full scale, they refused to take over the cleanup effort from TEPCO, make it an international effort. The United States and other countries basically refused to press that, refused to stop making war and all over the world and, you know, deploying massive amounts of resources towards destructive enterprise and actually focus on this world crisis that's going on. I mean, that's what's happening. And yeah, so of course we're punishing Japan because we're not really focusing on it in any kind of realistic way. We're basically being, you know, continuing business as usual at a time when that's basically so far past what we need to do.
Yeah, well, along with that, on the flip side of that is that Japan isn't allowing any information out as well. So they're doing their own disservice and their own severe damage to their own people by not allowing medical statistics to come out. Those statistics come out in drips to us. We have people who come from Japan just to tell us what's going on, because if they tell us from over there, they'll get arrested. And these are, doctors will lose their licenses if they tell what it is that they're seeing, how many cases of thyroid cancers they're seeing in children, how many deaths they've already seen in children and just people. They can't tell us that. And that's their own government's doing. So they have their own massive part in this play that is happening of mass destruction.
Which helps the disinformation specialists in the blogosphere who say, oh, you know, there's less deaths than happened in, you know, at Chernobyl or this or that.
Right. We have no idea. We can only deduce how many deaths there are because of what we have found out from Chernobyl and how much worse Fukushima Daiichi is from the Chernobyl accident. So we have ideas, but until those numbers can get out, and we're talking get leaked out because they are under incredible banishment and punishment if they tell.
And they probably can't even talk to each other to coordinate compiling information.
Right.
Right.
But you mentioned something, and I just wanted to bring it up because it's really important with the what do we do about this stuff, you know? How can we deal with it? And there is something that we haven't, we all dropped the ball somewhere. I'm not sure where, but it needs to get picked up to the question of what can we do for the Pacific now and the people. We can protest loudly inside the UN and demand that we have a team put together to deal with this earth crisis. And this is an earth crisis. This isn't just Japan. This isn't just the West Coast. This is the entire earth. Fukushima Daiichi hit the entire earth. And what we have to do is get back on the ball to create a team of scientists, of engineers, and leaders from the anti-nuclear movement to oversee this. Because without us there, whoever we are, you know, we all know each other for the most part. Without us there, we still won't know if this is going to be part of the PR team or not. And if we can have those three things happen and we can get Japan to crack so that we can get in, then we might get somewhere. It's what you said earlier at the top of the show, Paul. You know, we don't know what we could have created to stop this from happening because no one was allowed in to even see what happened with this triple meltdown. And that triple meltdown was happening within 4 hours of this event. So this has been going on for, I mean, really, when we say 24/7 for 4 years, and this is just the beginning. As you can see from those fish samples, we're going to know every year how much worse this was from the beginning and every day forward. Every day it gets worse.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. We're speaking the truth here to the best that we're able, since it seems like our corporate and government overlords don't seem to want to take that responsibility on. So to the extent that we're able, we do that here at KBOO Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio, and I'm speaking with Mimi Gurman with No Nukes Northwest, and she is here with us to talk about Fukushima and its legacy and its ongoing effects on the world that we live in. And there's an event this afternoon at noon at Pioneer Courthouse Square here in Portland, a Requiem for the Ocean. And Mimi will talk a little bit more about that. I want to let you know what's coming up here on KBOO. Before I go to our first caller, I did notice that you're there patiently waiting, but hold on just another couple minutes. So at 9 o'clock today on Political Perspectives, Elaine Scarry is the guest. In her most recent book, Thermonuclear Monarchy, Scarry reminds us that only one man has the power to end life for everyone else by launching nuclear weapons, the President of the United States. She offers a new line of arguments and strategy for the nuclear disarmament movement. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia News, headlines, and interviews with host Chris Andre. At 10:15, stay with us for Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's The Dirtbag, hosted by Glenn Andreessen. On the show, the focus is on fruit tree pollination. Do your trees have what it takes to ensure good fruit production? And as always, they'll answer your gardening questions, feature a new plant of the month, a new garden stumper, and what's going on in the honeybee hive this month. And we do want to once again thank all of you KBOO members for your great support. Remember that KBOO exists on your financial contributions as well as your volunteer efforts and your calling in and supporting us in that way or whatever way you want to contribute. Want to become a member, just go to kboo.fm and click on donate today, and thank you so much. So we have a question written in from someone, but before that, let's go to our first caller. Jack, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's it's a noble cause. Like many noble causes among the left liberal progressive sector, you really need to get contextualize your information, I think, maybe perhaps a little more accurately. You know, Japan is the size of, basically the length of California. It is long and narrow. Fukushima is in the upper Pacific side corner, not the corner quite, but quite far north. All the prevailing currents and wind are heads north and west. So all of Japan is not contaminated by this. The agricultural sector of the economy is about 1.5% of the GDP. Japan exports almost no grown food products, almost nothing. They grow so little, they import more than anything else. Their fishing fleets range all over the Pacific. They catch very few fish right near the coast of Japan. So what I'm suggesting is, in making your case, that probably should do a little bit more research on this before making a big issue about it. And that's the only thing I wanted to comment. And
hold on the air for a second. Well, okay. We appreciate people pushing back. And Mimi, what is there merit in what Jack says?
Well, I think when people speak and join the conversation, there's always some form of merit. Just being a part of the conversation is a plus. But we have people in Japan who send us, I'm looking at one right now by a man whose name is Bruce Brinkman, and he has been collecting data with photographs with a really good Geiger counter all over Japan. And what we know is that far south of Japan, south of Tokyo, all the way through Tokyo and south of Tokyo, we have plutonium soil. And that's just where Bruce happens to have walked. And he goes everywhere with his Geiger counter. I'm looking at his photographs right now with the Geiger counter readings. So for people to say who aren't over there and aren't looking at the soil for deposits from plutonium from the accident, you really have no basis to say these things that you're putting out. It just becomes more of a, you know, the PR game. So while I appreciate people coming into the discussion, it would be really cool to have people actually know data. And I know data, and the people I work with know data, and that's what we go by.
Well, how about the issue of rice? I mean, is it true that they are not exporters of rice?
Japan exports rice. In fact, Korea was one of the first places that banned anything coming in from Japan. They started the ball rolling, and they said, you have radiated food, we're not taking it.
Well, it would have been nice if Jack would have stayed on the line so we could actually have a back and forth. Do you have anything more to say about what Jack brought up?
What I also know is that word got out to us, to the world, that Fukushima, that the rice from the Fukushima prefecture is being fed to school children all over Japan, in order to support the so-called farmers in Fukushima prefecture. There are no farmers up there anymore. Nobody lives up there anymore, though the government's trying to get people to move back into this, you know, it's like suicide to move back there. The conversation needs to be about how much radiation are people receiving and how much radiated food and imports are we getting. I don't know specifically. I'm not an economist. What I know is where the radiation is, and it's everywhere.
So we have someone called in a question. How much material is left to leak? Tons? Hundreds of tons? I.e., is it 10% dispersed, almost all dispersed?
This question needs a little bit of clarity, and the clarity is that we have a couple different ways of getting that radiated water into the ocean. One is the water tank farms that are on the Fukushima prefecture that they put up hastily after this happened to try to contain the radiated waters that were coming out of, from the cooling systems. And those were put together, they weren't welded, they were bolted together. So you have metal tanks with an unknown amount of water in each one, since none of them have gauges on them. So to answer this question, it's a very difficult one. The Japanese workers there decided not to put gauges on these tanks. So we really don't know how much water was even in each of these tanks, though, you know, there is a capacity for what they could hold, and then there are the leaks from them. So that's the tanks. There are so many tanks, they have no room for more tanks. And those tanks, we know, are all leaking. So that's the first part. Then we get rain. So the rain comes down the hill behind the meltdowns, and it goes down the hill, it goes over the corium and gets super hot and radiated and then flows into the ocean. Now we have radiated groundwater as well because of the melt through with 3-corium. So anywhere you look, there is more radiated water, and it's all flowing into the Pacific. So there is no number that we can attach to this other than to say, something exponential. It's exponential growth. It never ceases. And this is one of those things where if we had a team put together, maybe we could, you know, build things that were a lot more appropriate than what they have right now and a lot more effective.
So the number again is 503-231-8187. And thought we had another caller, but we have about 20 minutes left. And, this is a pretty intense subject. Again, something that it's far away, difficult to measure, difficult to get access to good information. Maybe people would just prefer not to really think about it, you know, because what can we do? You know, we have put out this idea early on that we needed to have a coordinated international effort. That didn't go very far, but it still would help now, right?
It still would help. If we could get that, then we would also have access to the information with what's going on in Japan. So it's sort of a twofold answer. And one is dealing with the actual plant itself, and then being able to be on the inside in Japan, bringing information back out. And in order for this to happen, the government would have to lift their ban on information. So until that happens, and I think that that could happen. I mean, it's one country. I think that the UN could come together and say, no, we've had enough of this. You know, we waited far too long. We're 4 years way too late. And we're going to make you open up the doors. Now, again, I'm not a government expert. I don't know how this stuff works. I just know that right now it isn't working.
So is there anybody, any countries, any NGO actors that are active within the United Nations framework that have been making this case, that have been trying to shake things up at all?
I don't know who all the players were. I know who our players were, but I don't know from different countries who they were. I think that in my recollection, there were people from Germany who wanted to be involved, scientists. And I know that we had a lot of people here who wanted to be involved. Arne Gundersen, of course, and Bob Alvarez and others wanted to make a big push for this, but that, again, it didn't happen. And that doesn't mean that it can't happen. And I really think that one of the focuses that should happen this year, you know, from this day on, since this is the fourth anniversary of this accident, is we should focus on the UN. I mean, look at all of the things that Code Pink has been able to do with getting into government access meetings. I really think that this isn't something for the street. This is something for inside, and we need to refocus our attempts. And, you know, Harvey Wasserman is doing something, too, now, where he's come together with the anti-fracking movement in California. And so we're trying to get the environmental movement to understand that you have to include nuclear when you're talking about ways to go into alternative energy and why, and what needs to happen in order to flip the switch into solar, wind, and whatever else we come up with. So I am asking everybody, when you talk about coal and you talk about fracking and you talk about propane and all of these things that we know so much about, please include the nuclear issue. Just because it's invisible doesn't mean it's not killing us. And that's the thing. This is killing us. This is causing cancers in kids across the West Coast.
So we've got a full slate of callers all of a sudden. We have George. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul, and your guest. This is, of course, very important material. And I just finished reading the speeches from the Caldecott Symposium from 2012, and a number of them, they all point out grave things which will come up in the deteriorating health, very likely, of the people of Japan. But also another issue is one that you've just been talking about, which is the need for an international push to, I think, come up to the government of Japan and say, look, you can't handle this, and something has to be done to internationally, you know, the resources available internationally are a lot larger. So I would like, if there's anything that your guest and you, I missed about 2 minutes from what your conversation was talking about, if there's anything that you haven't talked or brought up about this, I think it needs to be brought up. And also, I would say, reading about Chernobyl over the last few years, it's quite apparent that the international community, including the former Soviet government and the successor governments, don't have a good record of being open and honest about it, but that New York Academy of Sciences report on Chernobyl maintains, and it's based on, I guess, hundreds and hundreds of papers published in Belarus and Ukraine and Russia, that there have been something over, I think it's over 750,000 people, or maybe 800,000 estimated dead at the time of the publication of the report in 2009. We could very well be looking at something like the same thing in Japan in a few years. It's time for, I believe, an international effort, and I don't know if going in the streets is a bad idea, but we need to wake up our entire population that we're now part of a nuclear disaster, or actually several nuclear disasters which have affected the background radiation all over the world. Alice Stewart says in the book about her that the background level of radiation has been doubled since 1940. I think probably now it's on the way to going up another significant notch. I'll get off here. I'm quite interested. This is fascinating and very, very, very important. Thank you again.
And thank you very much for calling in. And let's just go to our next caller. Peter, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Nervous. Thank you. So, all of my three kids are part Japanese, and had my last is still going to Richmond Elementary. And so it's a Japanese immersion school in Portland. And so in my mind, I kind of think, like, what would it be like to have the 10-year-old Japanese having a conversation with a 10-year-old American? And what could I learn from that as far as what they could teach us? And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
You know, the unfortunate thing about what I have to say is it could go one of two ways. If that child is in a family that is aware of what happened because they were from the area, then you would have an interesting discussion, you know, between the two kids. If that child was from somewhere in Tokyo, the chances are really good that that child has no idea what has happened because the PR campaign in Japan has been so, so thick that no one can really pierce it. And these are people who live in Japan who think everything is fine. And I've spoken with people from Japan who think everything is fine. So, you know, it'd be good to have people dialoguing. Dialogue is always the best way to go, to open up discussion and find out what you can. But in this case, because of the PR campaign in Japan, I don't know how it would end up.
You know, I actually met a couple of young Japanese, several young Japanese people actually at the event that you guys put on last year. And I actually haven't reapproached them to have them on the air, unfortunately. But That is an important conversation to have. And if there is anybody out there from the Japanese or Japanese American community who has any insights or has any communication with people over there on the other side of Pacific, would really welcome your perspective. And hopefully I will actually have someone on the air before too long. But we do have one more caller. Kelly, you're on the air.
Thank you for covering this topic. It is so easy to ignore because mainstream media cut it off before there was even any evidence as to what was happening. But I did see, I'm a suburban mom, and I did see about 9 months after the accident, this high occurrence of the export of seaweed treats and snacks. The moms are feeding their kids. Costco has a huge stock of it, and also even places like Trader Joe's, you look on the back, it says it is from Japan. And so I just, you know, something I had never seen before. It wasn't very popular, and it wasn't until this happened that now we're feeding it to our families in America. I just wanted to mention that.
Well, thank you. That's an important piece of information.
I've seen those at Costco and at Trader Joe's. I look for these things, and you know where else I've seen it? I've seen it at Food Front at the co-op. And until people get together to call these companies up to say that you are concerned about what's in their products, these are going to stay on the shelves because, again, our government isn't going to stop these imports from happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your work.
Okay, and thank you very much for your call. And, yeah, we still have a few minutes left, 503-231-8187. I'm speaking with Mimi Gurman with No Nukes Northwest. Maybe talk a little bit more about the event at Pioneer Square, if you have something else you want to talk about.
No, I can talk about that, and then back to the water again. Today's event is really a time for people to come together to, whether it's mourn or come together to put out their sense of spirituality and energy into all of our ocean life to give it the love that we need to give it. It has nowhere to go. And because we are all of energy, I believe that there's only a positive outcome in that, no matter how little or how strong. And I couldn't think of another thing to do for today. You know, writing another letter to the Japanese Prime Minister is what many people are doing around the world today. We did that last year. And for me personally, the kind of activist that I am, I like to know that what I'm doing is actually making a dent and doing something. And for me, this was something to have people come together and share their thoughts, share their love, share their fear, share whatever it is that you want to share. And I'm hoping that children will come, because there's nothing like having a message of love come from the kids. So if you have kids, please bring them. This is not a protest. This is a gathering to communicate together and not feel so isolated with such a tragedy that's happening in our ocean. I do want to let folks know, too, that this is some of the stuff that comes out of Japan with regarding information about the water. You'll get these headlines. We get these headlines that say, TEPCO is trying to stop 30 million becquerels of cesium water with sandbags and blue sheeting. So what this means, don't concern yourself so much with the amount of measurement because it's hard to understand. 30 million becquerels of cesium is so high, I can't even explain to you how cancerous that is. It's deadly. But they're trying to stop this water flow with this amount of radiation in it with sandbags and blue sheeting. This is so common for what TEPCO does. They're trying to block water with some sandbags. We're talking about millions of gallons of water on a constant basis, not necessarily all at one time, but throughout every day. And every few weeks, we get another headline like this from TEPCO. TEPCO, for those who don't know, is they're the owners of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. And they're completely ineffective. They really don't know what's happening. They don't, and they've said this. We've had people come out and say, we have no idea how to fix this. We have no idea what we're doing. We're scrambling. We're trying. And in the meantime, they're preventing an international group to come in to do better.
And what's really behind this, I mean, there's so many things behind it. Obviously, there's the whole refusal to, ongoing refusal to have open information about the nuclear industry because the fear that it would shut down the nuclear industry. That's obviously maybe number one. The other one is this absurd deference, you know, division between public and private, this insane deference. Perhaps there's something in, you know, that accentuates it in Japanese culture itself. You know, I don't want to make ethnocentric, you know, statements, but that could be, I don't know. But certainly that division between the public and the private, sort of like, you know, it's a private industry, so they should be able to, you know, they have to figure it out because you can't, you know, who knows what the rationale is. But, I mean, those seem to be two, I don't know, what do you think is really going on there?
Well, I think that what you've said is true, and I would add the term, this is from what I've heard, because I certainly knew almost nothing about Japanese culture before this has happened, and I don't know that much about it now. What I have heard from people who do know and who are Japanese, this is just what people have told me, is that pride is an important part of the culture, as well as humility. And with the combination and this the enormity of this event and this accident, how do you work around that? How do you forgive yourself as the owners of this catastrophe and allow people in when you're dealing with both pride and humility? They counterbalance each other in a way that doesn't really work for the whole. Now, I don't know if this is a reality or not. This is something that I've heard.
Well, I think that would work for any cultural framework, mm-hmm. but maybe there's just particularities for the Japanese framework that add into it.
One of the things, too, that I do know has happened is that money, back to money and greed, and we have the same issue here in the United States with our nuclear power. For those who don't know, Olympia, Washington, the law has changed now. I don't know if it's a law, but it's going to go into effect where nuclear engineers and part of the nuclear PR team is going to be adding their say into 8th grade through 12th grade classes in their curriculum. So in the science curriculum, there's going to be pages, chapters in there coming from the nuclear industry about nuclear engineering with no other converse side to that story. So you know, this is how deep this PR campaign is all across the world. And GE is who built Fukushima Daiichi, GE, who is who built our Columbia Generating Station in Washington. GE, who was found guilty from the Columbia Generating Station when it was found guilty of selling faulty parts around the world, knowingly selling faulty parts to nuclear power stations around the world. And they got a fine, and a judge told them that you know, they couldn't believe that this was happening, that this is such Russian roulette. And in the meantime, nobody has shut down nuclear power when we know that the makers of the parts that go into a nuclear power plant were sold again around the world with faulty parts.
It just never ends. So we got a full slate of callers. Let's try to fill at least a couple of them in. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hi, I live in Berkeley, California, and we have the Diablo Canyon power plant down here. The problem is that with the hundreds of tons of radioactive water entering into the oceans in Fukushima year after year, here we've had severe drought, and there's more saltwater intrusion into our freshwater aquifers. If Diablo Canyon had a nuclear catastrophe like Fukushima, they'd be dumping incredible amounts of highly radioactive water into the West Coast. And that water would be, so you'd have radioactive saltwater intrusion into our freshwater aquifers. And at the same time, they want to build 17 desalination plants. And I wrote Dr. Helen Caldicott and asked her if desal plants could filter out the radioactive material. She said no, that the emitters would go through, and so people would be drinking radioactive toxic water from the ocean. And it's hell. So in order to preserve the last stand of water before they radiate it, we have to close Diablo Canyon and every power plant on the West Coast, and especially since the Cascadia subduction zone produces the largest earthquakes, 0.9. It's connected with the San Andreas Fault, which is connected with the Hasgari Fault, and all those, the combined network could overcome the 7.5,
capacity earthquake. Diablo, yes, Canyon, you're right.
Yeah, so so we have to close these nuclear power plants as fast as we can if we want to save our freshwater resources.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for calling in with that. Let's go straight to our next caller.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
A couple of points. She talked about water running through the plant and lots of water outflowing to the ocean. Not all of this is coming directly from rain, but there are streams, and the terrain there is wet, much like Oregon. And the amount of rain flow that goes into groundwater that flows through the site is a huge source of this water that they're unable to control. Also, you talked about private businesses being, you know, hands-off in terms of government control in Japan. Well, that's the same effort that major corporations banksters are trying to do here, is that, oh, anything to do with private business or regulatory oversight is sacrosanct and off grounds if they get their way. And this is the kind of repercussions we'll have. And about saving face, Japan is a lot, the culture, as I understand it, is a lot about personal responsibility, but also personal dignity. And if they have to admit that they have erred or harmed other people, that's a huge loss of face and standing. And it tends to be carried on intergenerationally. So people are very hesitant to admit that or take that on as a personal responsibility. And so are businesses, because they're reflections of the people that own them, work in them, and run them. That's my two cents. Thanks for your work. A great day.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. We have one more caller. Let's try to... Maurice, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Okay.
We have a minute.
I'm 67 years old, and I grew up in Southern California as a surfer. And I used to surf a lot by the San Onofre power plant in San Clemente. And it's really... it never was an actual observation, but most of my surfer buddies have died from cancer, three of them from leukemia. And it wasn't until just recently, I am a father of five children, grandfather of 12, and I came down with a bout of cancer a while ago, and so I started looking into things. I'm not much of a data collector, but I do consider myself fairly observant. And I was in the library, and I checked out a DVD called What in the World Are They Spraying? Because in Oregon here, we get a lot of chemtrails, and of course, you know, that's a conspiracy theory to a lot.
Okay, actually, I'm sorry. We are actually plumb out of time. I'm not cutting off because of the subject, but we actually have to wrap up this very second. People got to call in a little earlier. I really appreciate your calling in and everybody else's calling in. And I just wanted to mention that there's a deadline for the Jordan Cove Pacific Connector Pipeline Project. DEQ comment periods were requested due to Friday, March 13th. DEQ 401 water quality certification comments and air quality permit comments are due Friday, April 3rd. I will link to all this information and stuff that Mimi, my guest Mimi, put out. And thank you so much, Mimi.
Thanks, Paul, for all the work you do. Thank you, KBOO.
All right. And we're going to have to wrap it up with that. KBOO.FM is our website. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for more great programming.
Looks like these kids are going to have some fun, doesn't it?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Cocoon and their first public storytelling event on Thursday, March 12th at 5 p.m. at Lola's Room in Portland. The theme of this first storytelling event is Risk. PDX Cocoon is a student-led group that is working to facilitate storytelling for Portland youth through workshops and events. Again, that's Episode 1, Risk, by PDX Cocoon on Thursday, March 12th, 5 p.m. at Lola's Room, below the Crystal Ballroom at 1332 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'd sure hate to be left out.
Good morning. The time is 9:01.